Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Susan Henking. Henking is a graduate of the University of Chicago Divinity School. For over 20 years, she has been on the faculty of Hobart and William Smith Colleges in the Religious Studies Department, where she also served twice as chair. She was recently elected as the 14th president of Scheimer College, a four-year private liberal arts college located on the campus of the Illinois Institute of Technology. In addition to teaching courses in religious studies, Henking also taught women's studies, sociology, literature, and queer theory. She has published dozens of scholarly works on everything from religion to psychology, gender, sexuality, and leadership in higher education. She has also written two books and is the founding series editor of the Teaching Religious Studies series, soon to be published by Oxford University Press. And welcome to the show, Susan.
It's lovely to be back.
Yeah, nice to see you. Now, you've been in education and a scholar for over 20 years, and you're also starting to delve into the meaning and value of higher education. What made you start thinking about these issues?
Well, you know, part of it is that I'm a first-generation college goer, and going to college transformed my life. I went to college in the mid-70s when places were starting to give a lot of financial aid and bring people in who wouldn't otherwise have been able to come. I'm, alas, moving towards the end of a career, and I think it's really important to give back to sustain those ideals and make sure everyone can get the kind of advantage that I got. Uh-huh. And I don't think it's true these days in some ways. In my youth, a Pell Grant paid 80% of the tuition at an extremely expensive school. Today, it does not pay anywhere near that at an inexpensive school, let alone an expensive school.
Yeah.
So,
You say that you think higher education is at a crossroads right now, too. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's at a crossroads in a couple of ways. One is there's a lot of social changes that are affecting higher education. There's demographic changes, there's technological changes, there's changes in the nature of leadership, and certainly since 2008, but even before then, there were significant economic changes. So for me, one of the really important things is even when you say a private liberal arts college, you're also talking about public goods and the public value of it. In my youth, right, a public education place like SUNY, for example, or the University of Illinois, tuition was 25% of the cost, and we as taxpayers paid the other 75%. It's flipped now. Mm-hmm. In private education, right, we are still dependent on federal and state money and tax money for a whole range of things, capital, buildings and things like that, student loans, but more importantly, student grants. And so the more we reduce our commitment to spending our tax dollars on that, the more we privatize and the more we make higher education, on the one hand, the next bubble, and on the other hand, the cause of kids' debt. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a crossroad for a range of reasons.
Yeah, yeah. No, it makes sense to me because the world is so rapidly changing in so many ways. Yeah. Now, more and more women are entering the education system, especially higher education, but there's still so few women in the administration or even in the faculty. Mm-hmm. Well, why do you think that is? And is it getting better?
I think there are a couple of reasons, some historic and some, I think, just the structure of society. It's true. These days, the average undergraduate in the United States is no longer an 18 to 25-year-old game. Mm. And the majority are women. At liberal arts colleges, on average, it's about 60 women to every 40 men at the student level.
That's a lot.
It's disproportionately women. And then at the administrative level, if you look at presidencies especially, Harvard and a few other places to the contrary notwithstanding, it's 25% women leaders. It's disproportionately true that women leaders are at community colleges, and it's disproportionately true that they're also at Ivies. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of students go to community colleges or something other than Ivies. So I think the reasons are a couple. Alice Eagley and some of her colleagues have written a book, Through the Labyrinth, and they argue that we should get rid of the glass ceiling metaphor now. Because everybody can point to the president of Harvard, who's Drew Gilpin Faust, who's a woman. Mm-hmm. But the route to leadership is more complex and less direct than men's route to leadership. So that's one argument I'd make. I think also it's increasingly the case that the preparation for leadership in universities and colleges requires the development of expertise. And it is, while organizations like the American Council on Education or the Harvard New Presidents Institute, things like that exist, it's only the Higher Education Resource Services, which is a women's organization started in the 70s, that focuses explicitly and continuously on the development of women leaders. In 1974, they started saying, you got to know how to understand computers. You got to know how to understand a budget. This is not relevant to my current employment, but you have to understand athletics. Mm-hmm. The most common reason for a woman president to lose her job is athletics.
You have to understand the importance of it, especially, huh?
And I mean, we sit in a town right now talking, Ithaca, which has had some very substantial women presidents. Peggy Williams at Ithaca College, for example, and a provost from Cornell, Biddy Martin, who went to the University of Wisconsin, now at Amherst. Right. But we are still the exceptions, not the rule. And openly lesbian and gays are still the exceptions, not the rule. And men and women of color are still the exceptions.
That seems to be a problem in the broader culture, mm-hmm. too. I mean, everybody complains about we don't have enough women in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I go back to what I have been thinking for many years. We don't have places where women learn to be leaders.
I think that's
right. You hear women with these victim voices. They don't mm-hmm. know how to public speak. And so we have to change that.
And we need the institutions to do it. In the case of politics, for example, there's Emily's List on the one hand, or there's the White House Project, which is also working very hard and has been for decades to develop women leaders from the municipal to the state to the federal level. And I think it's true in higher education as well as in politics, although I'm not an expert in politics by any means, that there's a direct relationship between the number of women and the prestige of the position.
Mm.
You can predict in higher education. This is not a causal argument, it's a correlation, but the higher prestige the institution is, the fewer women full professors there are. And I think the higher you go up in the pecking order of politics, I think there's fewer women inside the U.S., but, you know, other nations have solved that problem.
Oh, absolutely.
By solving it structurally.
I mean, even Pakistan has a woman president or has had
mm-hmm.
a woman president. I know. And then little tiny countries in Northern Europe have. Yeah. Mary Robinson was the president mm-hmm. of Ireland and so on. It's very interesting how backward we are, although we call ourselves a role model of modern world, you know.
I'm completely with you. You know, one of our biggest exports is actually liberal arts colleges. All sorts of places, including in the Middle East and Asia and other places, are creating liberal arts colleges. And often they're led by women, whereas here it's only 3% of undergraduates go to a small liberal arts, something below 5,000 or below. It's about 3% of the population.
Wow.
So we no longer do for our young people what people all over the globe are saying they need, which is not only technical education and not only workforce preparation, but learning to learn.
Yeah, and in being lifelong learners, as I mm-hmm. see a missing piece mm-hmm. of it with these mm-hmm. people who don't go to college or don't care about education. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about your new position. Congratulations, too. You have been elected as the 14th president, only the mm-hmm. second woman mm-hmm. of Scheimer College. Tell us about the college.
Scheimer is an amazing place. I met it in the process of a job search, of course, and I immediately recognized something in it. And what I recognized actually is very much out of bounds. It is not in the mainstream of higher education in many ways, and yet, it is in the mainstream. It's a small college. I'm trying to stop saying small because people mistakenly believe size predicts impact. We believe very firmly in a community of inquiry, a community of criticism, a community of generosity and hope. So we are intentionally small. Our goal is to be around 300 because we think that's how we can do it, where people consistently learn from each other. We have a curriculum that was created by a guy named Robert Hutchins in the 1950s. So that sounds like I have now left the mainstream for retrograde, but not so much. It is retro in the sense that it has a commitment to reading primary historic texts in small groups. But because we revise it consistently, among the primary core texts people all graduates read are the Declaration of Sentiments, written, as many people will know, in upstate New York Everyone will read the work of Carol Gilligan. Everyone will read feminist work, anti-racist work, and other work, as well as some works like Plato and Aristotle and things like that. So the curriculum asks them to read natural sciences, historic works, not to be historians of science, but to learn from that how to be a scientist, to read social science works and to read humanities works, and then also to do what are called integrative studies, things that bring them together. So 75% of our curriculum is required. 25% is electives, and among the electives, they can go to a faculty member and say, I want a course in this. And the faculty work to make it happen.
That's what we were talking about before, to make a well-rounded person mm-hmm. so that you can become a leader and know about the world around you and the culture around mm-hmm. you. It seems so logical to me.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about the college. I understand it was started by two women who were from upstate New York.
It's true. It was founded by Frances Wood and Cinderella Gregory. Cinderella's name is my favorite one, but Frances Wood is really, in many ways, the one of the drivers as well. They leave upstate New York to go to Illinois to found a seminary for women in the 1850s. They start this seminary in 1853, leaving a part of the country that I think of as the California of the 19th century, right? Upstate New York was filled with religious revivals, educational change, social and political movements like abolition, Native American work, mm-hmm. and the suffrage movement. And they take this fervor to a small place in Illinois called Mount Carroll, where they found a seminary for girls, which we're about to hit our 160th year in 2013. And in the intervening years, they did a number of really interesting things. They wanted land for their school. So Frances Wood marries a guy named Scheimer, gets the land. He moves to the East Coast, and she gets the land. So they use that land to have this seminary for girls. Over time, she makes friends with a guy named William Rainey Harper, who's the then president of the University of Chicago. He was 29 at the time. And they build a relationship over time that connects Scheimer Academy for Girls, which eventually becomes a junior college and then a four-year college, to the University of Chicago.
God, it's amazing.
It's a very amazing story. And they, because it's the history, I'm saying they, but it's truly a we here, they spent an enormous amount of effort really focusing on what does it mean to be educated. The early women's colleges, right, there were two kinds. One was, we're going to educate them in the same way we're educating men.
Mm.
And there were other ones that were sort of creating a protective environment and educating them to be spouses.
And etiquette and, yeah. and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And this one really focused on the education. In the intervening years between then, Scheimer moved from Mount Carroll to Waukegan, Illinois, and now is in the city of Chicago, and also moved to become more closely affiliated with the University of Chicago through curriculum and through faculty, and now is a standalone college that is, I would say, a place that leavens the world. We have alums that do quite astonishing things. From some of the music in the current movie, The Hunger Games, is from a Scheimer alum. You know, we have alums who are very significant entrepreneurs. One of our alums was one of the first women to work at IBM. And this has been true for a long time. We are per capita one of the highest producers of people who go on to get a PhD in the country. So, for example, a guy named Bob Cohane, who's probably one of the most important international relations theorists in the world, is a Scheimer alum.
Wow.
And there are lots of others whose names aren't as widely known, but across all those decades, they've leavened the worlds they've lived in really interesting ways.
Yeah, that's fascinating, coming from such a small
yeah.
place. Tell us a little bit about how you're going to approach your role as a leader. I mean, you've never done this before.
That's true. I've never been a president before, which I occasionally have to say to them. I think the way I'm trying to approach this is that I think one form of leading is by learning. And so one of the things that's a core value of Scheimer is the way in which faculty and staff and students learn together. So that's one part of what I'm trying to show, that I need to learn the place well to advocate for it, and also because I do believe in lifelong learning. I'm trying to balance two things. Leadership is about management, making sure the institution is running effectively, making sure that it is abiding by the many regulations the government has chosen to force higher education into abiding by and reporting on, right? But then to also stand for Scheimer in talking to the external world, as today, for example, and be able to be a voice for them, and a voice that says both inside and outside how important it is to sustain the diversity of higher education.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Susan Hanking. She's just been appointed the new president of Scheimer College in Chicago, and we're talking about higher education. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Sure. One of the things that I think about higher education is, if you watch over that 160 years that Scheimer's existed, we have created new kinds of higher education institutions, and we've also, in an odd way, narrowed the range of higher education in the United States. So one of the things I really believe is that we're all better off if there are a variety of kinds of institutions. An easy way to say this, sitting in Ithaca, New York, is, right, there's Cornell, which is in itself a complicated public and private institution, and Ithaca College, which is a complicated institution, and we're near a whole range of other kinds of institutions physically here.
Amazing amount of colleges in this area.
And nationally, right, it's really important to have state institutions and private institutions, to have large and small, and to have ones that are focused on a particular topic, like the Parsons School of Design on the one hand, and others like Scheimer that really focus on what it means to be a generally educated person with depth and breadth and the capacity to think critically. So I think the diversity of kinds of institutions is really important. And I think the diversity of kinds of leaders is really important.
Oh, absolutely.
Well.
And that's where we need to continue to work harder.
I think that's right.
That's what probably everybody would agree with. Now, I know this college that you're going to be taking the reins of, or have taken the reins of, comes from traditions. Are you going to make any major changes? Do you feel like anything has to come into the modern world and change?
I think there's at least three really major things that we have to attend to. One is we are struggling as a nation with what education is for, and there's a perception out there that education is also workforce development. And so one of the things we really have to work on at Scheimer is making clear why this education is actually a practical education as well as an end in itself. Mm. So that's, I think, a really core thing we have to do. A second thing we really have an opportunity to do is we sit now, unlike our prior century and a half, on the campus of the Illinois Institute of Technology in Bronzeville, which is second to Harlem as historically crucial for African Americans. So we have the opportunity, because we're the only great book school that's in a major urban area, that's in connection with, we lease space, but we also, our students can take courses from IIT and vice versa, has a strong relationship to technology, engineering, and to those kinds of fields. So I think focusing on what our uniquenesses are is going to be important, because those are matching the needs of our nation and our planet.
Do you have a very big population of African Americans enrolled in the college? Do you know?
I can make it sound like we do, because we're about 20% students of color. Mm-hmm. But if you remember, we're fairly small. So that's one of our things that we really have to, I think, focus on. The majority of Americans who are going to college these days are not white and not 18 to 25, mm-hmm. but almost all students of color go to very large institutions. So as we approach this, right, we've got to approach it through the lens of our history and our stewardship of place. I recently had a meeting with Carol Adams, who's the leads the DuSable Museum in Chicago, which is one of the very earliest African American history museums. And developing a relationship with them, I think, is going to be very important for us. She already had an existing relationship with Scheimer through her family, who attended Scheimer in the past. But what we're going to try to do is develop relationships with cultural institutions in Chicago and others, so that our population will never be huge, but our responsibility will be both to make sure that everybody who leaves, regardless of their racial ethnic background, understands and is committed to understanding the history of our world through that lens as well, but also bringing more and more people into the population that reads these texts.
Yeah.
African Americans and Latinos are disproportionately homeschooled now, and we serve homeschooled populations pretty well. And also African Americans and Latinos are having a hard time in high school. And one of the distinctive features of Scheimer that I want to bring back, it has always been there, but it's important in a new way today, is in the early entrant program. Mm. We, as some other institutions, have a very substantial early entrant program. when we had that relationship with the University of Chicago I mentioned, students might have started college at 15 or 16. We still have some people who do that. And I think high school is very, very tough for a lot of people in around issues of difference. And one way to address some of that is to get them out of the high schools into an educational setting that, that is really a community.
I think more and more people need to do that. That has been an issue that I've seen at the forefront for many years. Mm-hmm. Now, because you come from religious studies, I have to ask you this. Are you concerned about the seeming war between science and religion that seems to be being waged in universities and in the public forums?
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting thing. I will say one more thing about Shimer and then address your question. When you look at small institutions, 500 and below, Shimer is one of the very few secular institutions.
Hmm.
The reason I raise that is because, in a way, it addresses the question. Shimer students, faculty, and staff are intellectually and politically very diverse. As a joke, I have taken to saying I have met people there who think the Tea Party is way too liberal, and people who think the Trotskyites still exist. And I kind of say that because, in answer to your question about science and religion, because I've also met people in this context who are on every conceivable side of that. And what I like about the Shimer educational experience is they engage in informed civil discourse with each other. And just as they do it about politics, and really I've never seen somebody ever who thought the Tea Party was too liberal have a serious conversation that was humane with somebody who thought the Trotskyites still exist. That is a kind of cartoon of what I've seen. But the same is true for us around the science-religion debate. I've got very seriously embedded religious people and very, very seriously embedded
creationists.
And either anti-religious or just secular people.
Mm.
So what I think about this whole debate, this is a long, I went around to the left to get to my answer, is what we can do is support open discourse about this rather than Jeremiads, right? We've got people in our culture screaming at each other about this as opposed to talking with each other about this. And that's what I like about Shimer. My own position on it is I'm pretty secular myself. In fact, I would say I'm entirely secular. My belief is that in order to have a fully open culture, we have to really think about religion a lot, because too many people inside certain forms of religion have very closed discourses, and too many people inside certain forms of atheism have closed discourses. And so we all face this paradox of, if you're so open that you include everybody, you include somebody who try to rule you out. And I think that's part of what's going on in this debate, with important thinkers essentially screaming at each other over the legitimacy of each other's positions.
Yeah.
And my own critical engagement would say we're too often comparing good versions of one, whatever we mean by good. Good versions, sorry, I just realized I did scare quotes and they don't convey very well on the radio. good versions of one thing to bad versions of the other.
Mm.
And it would be better if we would compare good versions of religion, for example, to good versions of science. Good versions of science are not cookbook science. They're critical open inquiry. In my view, good versions of religion, similarly, they're about critical open inquiry.
But it's still a tough debate. I mean, there are some people who don't want people to teach evolution anymore. So, you know, you have to figure out how you're going to...
And there have been court cases that also don't want people to teach about Islam.
Right.
They don't want people to teach. There was one in New York, which didn't get very far, that accused feminism of being a religion and thus an illegitimate enterprise in a secular institution. You know, I do think people are using the courts and law, as we have across our history, to try to exclude other people's perspectives.
That's right.
And my own view of it is this. Beyond the fact that we should be educating everybody to engage in open inquiry, also people should know how to tell the difference between a generally agreed upon theoretical framework and the absence of factual argument.
Mm.
And so you can then tell from that my position. I am not a creationist. I think it functions in some ways that sustain certain communities. I think evolution works in some ways to sustain certain communities, but I think it's more accurate, wildly more accurate.
And that's exactly what education is about, right? Yeah, I mean, because we could get into philosophy, and we can bring that into that realm. To talk to us a little bit more about that women's leadership organization that you're a part of, the Higher Education Resource Services, to tell us a little bit more about that.
You know, I'm not involved with it anymore, but I am a product of it. In the 1970s, there were a lot of institutions and organizations created to help women get positioned to be part of other organizations. And higher education at the time had relatively few tenured or tenure-track women in the faculty and relatively few administrators. So a group of women got together and decided that this was not because women were mentally disabled or incapable, but because the structures of mentorship and support were not there that were present for other people. So they created institutes at Wellesley and Bryn Mawr and in Denver that provided, in a kind of boot camp way, through institutes, all of the things that people were learning through mentors in other contexts. So what HERS did at the time was pick the areas that women were most underrepresented in and get people educated in those areas. As a side effect, the NCAA, for example, has a Women's Leadership Institute that was originally a HERS thing. There's a HERS thing in South Africa that works to educate women there, but it continues to be important in the United States. Each summer, women go to Bryn Mawr. Across the year, people go to Denver or to Wellesley to learn the things that we're not learning. Perhaps this is no longer true, but in 1974, we weren't learning them in the locker room. We needed to learn them somewhere else.
We had to create our own locker room. Susan Hanging, we only have a couple of minutes left. I want to ask you about yourself. I mean, you're embarking on this incredibly new and exciting career move. Are you going to continue teaching? Are you going to continue studying and writing?
You know, as a faculty member, I used to say I believe in being a teacher scholar, and as a president, I believe in being a teacher scholar administrator. And learner, as I've said. I don't think all teaching happens in the classroom, and I don't think it's going to be the case that in the immediate future I'm going to be in the classroom, because there's a lot of work to be done at Scheimer, and one of the things I learned in my prior work was how many people it takes to get one student and one faculty member together to transform lives. So I am trying to do that part of the teaching learning scholarship. I am writing still. I am commuting back and forth from Chicago to beautiful Geneva, New York, which I love. And I want to make sure that what I say about institutions is true about me. What I think about institutions is, as we're teaching students, we should model what we think, what we believe are our values. So I keep saying, folks, you have to have a life, because otherwise you're teaching students the wrong thing. Mm. Our institution needs to practice ethics, and so do we. And so one of the things I wish to teach the students of Scheimer, as I learn from my colleagues and learn from them, is I don't just have a job, I've got a life. And that, I think, goes to the women's leadership thing as well.
Yeah.
That we have to find ways to support each other in our vocations.
Well, Susan Hanking, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure talking to you, and good luck. Susan Hanking has been our guest. She's now the president of Scheimer College in the Chicago area. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thanks, everybody, for listening. I should say to you, www.scheimer.edu, which is S-H-I-M-E-R. Please come by. And if you're in Chicago, come by South State Street and visit us.
Great. Thank you, Susan Hanking. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.